In today's episode, Dr. Brian Hurley provides expert insights into the current state of stimulant use disorder, its implications across different regions, and available treatment options. Welcome to the Carlatt Psychiatry Podcast. I'm Dr. Noah Caperso, the editor-in-chief of the Carlatt Addiction Treatment Report and an associate professor of psychiatry at the Yale University School of Medicine. In this episode, we will explore the changing landscape of stimulant use disorder and its impact across different regions. We will be joined by Dr. Brian Hurley, who will share his expert insights on the current state of the stimulant drug supply, most commonly used drugs, and geographical variations in use patterns. We also explore the pharmacological and clinical distinctions between prescription stimulants and illicit substances like cocaine and methamphetamine, and shed light on the concerning uptick in stimulant-related morbidity and mortality, delving into the complex interplay of various substances in the ongoing overdose crisis. Dr. Hurley, can you please introduce yourself and share some information about your background before we proceed?
So my name is Brian Hurley. I'm an addiction physician, and I am the president of the American Society of Addiction Medicine.
And let's just start by having you give us an overview of the state of the stimulant drug supply, most prominent agents, and how these might differ by geography.
There's three major categories of stimulants that are used throughout the United States outside of a prescription context. So when we talk about non-medical use of stimulants, I'm not talking about psychostimulants prescribed for medical reasons, such as attention deficit disorder or other types of medical conditions. So psychostimulants have what is sometimes referred to as an abuse potential, and that is a source of, you know, stimulants in the drug supply that people use as prescription stimulants that have been procured outside of a pharmacy context and outside of medical purpose. And then there's methamphetamine. So I live in Los Angeles, California. Methamphetamine in my region is by far and away the most common stimulant we see used. And then in the United States, the other common stimulant is cocaine. And we do see regional differences. So I did my addiction psychiatry fellowship in New York City, where cocaine far exceeds methamphetamine in terms of prevalence. That was also true in Boston, where I was a psychiatry resident. But having grown up in Los Angeles and now back working in Los Angeles, here, methamphetamine far exceeds cocaine. So what we see across the United States is regional differences, where cocaine being more prevalent in parts of the East Coast of the United States, and methamphetamine being more prevalent in the Midwest on westward. And those are, of course, general rules. Individual people can use cocaine or methamphetamine. I am unaware of any part of the country that has zero of either. But in terms of prevalences, we see the prevalence of cocaine use being more prevalent on the East Coast and the prevalence of methamphetamine being more prevalent in the Midwest on westward.
And so you started by talking about prescription stimulants, and just like the opioid epidemic, where we've seen this kind of evolution from prescription drugs into illicit substances, and then an evolution of those, you know, further evolution of those illicit substances, we've seen a similar path actually with stimulants. Can you outline some of the kind of both pharmacological and clinical differences that are important for clinicians to know about with prescriptions versus these illicit stimulants, and then differences between cocaine and methamphetamines?
Well, there's a really important difference between non-medical use of prescription psychostimulants and the overdose crisis caused by opioids. So we did not see anywhere close to the same rates of psychostimulant overprescribing as we saw during the beginning of the opiate overdose crisis. So there are very material differences in clinician prescribing patterns that seem to cause or certainly substantially contribute to the opioid overdose crisis. We've not seen the same pattern again with prescription psychostimulants. That said, the clinical effects of amphetamines are similar, whether you're talking about lisdexamfetamine, which is a prodrug that metabolizes to amphetamine, dextroamphetamine, and amphetamine salts that are mixed, which doesn't require the metabolism step. The psychostimulant works faster. It's a, you might think of it as a higher impact to amphetamine in terms of, you know, clinically, it is a stronger pace of onset. And also the pharmacology of it is such that it wears off relatively quickly and therefore comes in an extended release formulation. And then drugs like methamphetamine, which absorb into the brain very, very quickly, they're what's called more lipophilic, so they pass the blood-brain barrier faster, have a, you know, very quick effect. And methamphetamine has a clinical effect that lasts much longer than many other amphetamine types, right? So those are some of the differences we've seen between like prescription amphetamines and the illicit amphetamines we see on the market. Methylphenidate, which is used a long time as a medical treatment for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, actually has a similar mechanism of action to cocaine. The difference being methylphenidate has a very different absorption pharmacology and a very different duration of action. So, you know, methylphenidate, again, affects dopamine reuptake out of the synaptic cleft, but you don't get nearly the same clinical activation from methylphenidate as you would see from something like cocaine. So there are really important safety differences between the psychostimulants that are prescribed and the illicit stimulants we see sold in our communities.
And how do you think about clinical differences between cocaine and methamphetamines, you know, the two most prevalent illicit?
The biggest difference is the duration of action. Cocaine, when somebody uses cocaine, and, you know, cocaine can be smoked, swallowed, injected, insufflated, right? It has a number of ways that people can use it, but it lasts for anywhere between 20 and 30 minutes, depending on the person. So when somebody's using cocaine, they're typically using cocaine several times throughout, say, a use episode. But a use episode might last, hypothetically, an evening or a day, right? It's not necessarily lasting, you know. Of course, there are people who might use cocaine for longer than that. You know, a typical use episode is, you know, relatively brief over the course of a part of a day. Methamphetamine lasts 12 to 15 hours after somebody uses it. So it's just the duration of intoxication effect is much, much longer. And when people use methamphetamine multiple times, you'll see people that use methamphetamine over the course of like a weekend, right? Multiple days in a row, or, you know, half of a week. Now, that's a half of a week where people are usually either not sleeping or have very diminished sleep. And as a result, you know, when I was training on the East Coast and I saw people with cocaine intoxication, those intoxication syndromes tended to resolve relatively quickly. You know, keep your eye on somebody for an hour or two and, you know, their intoxication, you know, resolves. With methamphetamine, you'll see people intoxicated for hours. I mean, there's people taken care of in the psychiatric emergency room for many, many hours where they have, I'll call it psychosis of unclear origin, right? I don't know if they have an underlying psychotic disorder, but I do know they're exhibiting psychotic symptoms that seems to persist for hours and hours, and it takes much longer for somebody to clear. So that's just one key difference between methamphetamine and cocaine is the duration, and drugs that last longer and impact core brain functions like sleep functions tend to have a more severe set of psychiatric comorbidities that I've seen.
Would you say that longer time course of methamphetamine is related to what I think are seen as higher rates of some of these other kind of like, you know, adverse effects that's associated with long-term stimulant use?
So the physical comorbidities, both from cocaine and methamphetamine, are significant. But yeah, if you look at drugs that land somebody, say, in the coroner's office here in Los Angeles, right, drugs that are involved with fatal overdose. Now, keep in mind, I live in an area where methamphetamine use is at baseline more common than cocaine use. But we see comparable amounts of methamphetamine and fentanyl involved in fatal overdoses here in LA County. Methamphetamine is a huge driver of overdose. Now, that's not to say that the people with methamphetamine-involved overdose weren't also potentially impacted by fentanyl. So it's not I'm not saying the presence of a drug means that it was clearly due, you know, the cause of death was clearly due to that drug. What I'm saying is, in the geography where I live and work, methamphetamine is a huge driver of overdose. And if you look at methamphetamine overdoses that don't involve fentanyl, you see things like hemorrhagic stroke, heart attacks. You see a whole number of medical consequences of long-term stimulant use. Now, do people still have those consequences with cocaine? Sure, but that's not what we're seeing in terms of the actual frequency of overdose and death in our community. So I'm not saying cocaine is safe and methamphetamine is not. That's not what I'm saying. But what I am saying is a longer acting stimulant has a greater risk of having a stronger effect on somebody's physiologic function.
For sure. That makes intuitive sense as well. Actually, that sort of dovetails nicely with the next question, which is, you know, if you look at overdose death rates, we're seeing a very concerning uptick in stimulants. So just the number of people with morbidity and mortality secondary to stimulants is really kind of increasing. Why do you think that's happening? Why are we seeing that?
So when we think of the overdose crisis in the United States, and I've stopped calling it the opioid crisis, and I really do think it's an overdose crisis, what we're seeing is, you know, wave one being prescription opioids, wave two being heroin, which was relatively short-lived when we begin to look at the overall chronology. Then the synthetic opioid fentanyl being the next driver. Fentanyl remains a huge driver, but I think what we're seeing is overdoses involving sedatives and overdoses involving stimulants on top of the existing high overdose rate related to fentanyl describes the fourth wave of the overdose crisis being multiple drugs. And I'll tell you, it's not just stimulants. It's also sedatives and opioids. In other words, there's something about the combination of these drugs in the drug supply that is particularly risky and dangerous. Again, I live and work in Los Angeles. In my community, it's the synthetic stimulant methamphetamine and the synthetic opioid fentanyl that seems to be driving most of the public health risk. That's what we're seeing here in LA. And we know that there are people that use both, you know, that co-use both fentanyl and methamphetamine, which appears to be quite risky. We also know of people that, you know, they use, say, methamphetamine and sedatives, or, you know, they use other substances. And there, again, is a risk associated with mixing drugs or using drugs around the same time as each other on its impact, both on our overall, you know, brain health and physiologic function, but also as a risk factor for overdose.
It seems to be an emerging problem having people buying one drug and ending up with something either mixed in unknowingly or maybe something completely different. I mean, oftentimes fentanyl now is tainting everything. So somebody may go out trying to buy methamphetamine and end up, you know, experiencing a fentanyl overdose. Do you have a sense of the prevalence of this? How common is it that something like fentanyl is being found in methamphetamines?
That is an excellent question with a somewhat complicated answer. There is the assumption that all methamphetamine, and for that matter, all cocaine, has fentanyl in it. And what I'm going to say is somewhat paradoxical. If that were true, actually, we could develop a better system for treating that, right? If we knew that that was true universally, then we can treat everyone that uses illicit stimulants as though they had a co-occurring opioid use disorder. And we've got great treatments for opioid use disorder, right? We've got methadone and buprenorphine, center release now trexone, you know, is an option, right? So we have good treatment. It's the uncertainty of whether a given drug has fentanyl in it that seems to be the riskiest component of this. Because everyone who uses a stimulant was equally tolerant to opioids, we would paradoxically see less overdose because we would just see across the board increased opiate tolerance. And it's not that fentanyl kills every single person that takes it. Fentanyl kills people, usually through respiratory arrest, for people who aren't tolerant to opioids. And because fentanyl is so high potency, it is so much less forgiving than other types of opioids between when somebody takes it and has an intoxicating effect and when they stop breathing. So what does this have to do with stimulants? This is a pretty good article that came out last year, November. These authors looked at what was the prevalence of fentanyl in methamphetamine and powder cocaine samples. And again, we're just talking about methamphetamine and powder cocaine. There is also crack cocaine, which is a different composition of the way cocaine can be formulated. And they came up with 12 to 15%, you know, like, again, was the overall average prevalence. What's interesting about that, though, was there was incredible variability between geographies. So when I talk to my academic partners, we're seeing close to zero of rates of fentanyl being incidentally found in other drugs, which means there are other geographies where that is much more common. So although across all of the drug checking services, I think they were looking at 25 geographies, they came up with 12 to 15%. I just wanted to highlight the variability in that. And so it's not just the presence of fentanyl. It's the unreliability of whether a drug that somebody buys has fentanyl in it that is, in fact, the riskiest part of using a drug from a, you know, from a non-pharmacy source where you don't know, you don't have any information about the supply chain. It's just the uncertainty of whether fentanyl or another type of intoxicant might be present.
One of the biggest challenges with stimulant use disorder, of course, and you sort of alluded to this relative to opioid use disorder, is what do you do for treatment? We don't have a methadone or a buprenorphine equivalent for stimulants. So can you go over some of the treatment options that are available?
Absolutely. So at the risk of appearing as though I'm trying to sell you something, ASAM and the American Academy of Addiction Psychiatry, so ASAM being the American Society of Addiction Medicine and the American Academy of Addiction Psychiatry, have actually published a national clinical guidance document that describes what clinicians should know about treating stimulant use disorder. So I'd love to just refer everybody to that because it goes through prevention and other secondary and tertiary prevention steps around dental health, harm reduction. There's a whole lot that clinicians can do working with people who are using stimulants that can help protect people's health and wellness. So that's one thing. Second thing is, you know, diagnosing stimulant use disorder is not actually fundamentally different than diagnosing any substance use disorder, right? So there's a set of 11 criteria. Those criteria are generally conserved across all substance categories, including stimulant use disorder. And the treatments for stimulant use disorder fundamentally are biopsychosocial. So we have medications, we have counseling, and we have other types of supports. And specific to stimulant use disorder, we've seen a huge response from a treatment called contingency management, or where somebody is provided an incentive for urine toxicology verified stimulant abstinence that seems to significantly increase the rates of stimulant abstinence. And it looks, you know, from the evidence, contingency management programs that last at least 4 months that are doing toxicology testing at what I'll say is a reasonable frequency. So twice a week is pretty common because most stimulants have a relatively short window for detection, do a good job of supporting people's remission from stimulant use disorder. So our guideline is very clear on contingency management being a treatment of choice. And one of the nice things about contingency management is you can combine it with high-intensity outpatient services as usual, right? So somebody goes to groups and counseling and gets other types of psychoeducation and psychotherapy that treat their stimulant use disorder. There is actually a manual called the Matrix Manual, and it's a manualized treatment for stimulant use disorder. And cognitive behavioral therapy, a well-known, validated psychosocial treatment for a whole number of conditions, is also effective at treating stimulant use disorder. And you mentioned we don't have a methadone or buprenorphine or extended-release naltrexone equivalent for, you know, which treat opioid use disorder to treat stimulant use disorder. And that is true. But there are medications, despite the fact that they are not FDA approved to treat stimulant use disorder, that are clinically effective at treating methamphetamine and cocaine use disorders. And we also describe those in our guideline. They include both non-controlled substances, so medications such as topiramate, naltrexone, bupropion, mirtazapine, have all been identified as promising candidates that seem to help people reduce their stimulant use. And that's really what we see in most of the trials is reduced stimulant use, as well as psychostimulants. So psychostimulants such as methylphenidate, mixed amphetamine salts, also can be considered in the treatment of methamphetamine and cocaine use disorder, respectively. But to the point that you actually brought up earlier, the clinical practice guideline has a caveat around the use of psychostimulants to treat stimulant use disorder, because there's this presumed equivalence, right? If methadone works for opioid use disorder, shouldn't, say, you know, X psychostimulant work for stimulant use disorder? And that is absolutely not the case, by which I mean it isn't true that any particular psychostimulant works as a substitution therapy. Like, that is not what we're seeing in the data. But if a clinician is going to use a psychostimulant outside of its FDA-approved indication to treat stimulant use disorder, ASAM and AAAP's opinion is that clinician should be a board-certified addiction physician or somebody who's in consultation with or sort of in supervision with a board-certified addiction physician who has, you know, commensurate training. Because you really do need to know what you're doing. What we don't want to see is a huge rise of psychostimulant prescribing like we saw with the opioid overdose crisis. That, you know, the patients are being comprehensively assessed. It's part of a comprehensive treatment program that really supports people's health and wellness. And, you know, people's safety is being monitored and diversion is being monitored. Well, those are all the things that we know that addiction board-certified addiction physicians are pretty familiar with. And so that was caveat language that we put in related to off-label psychostimulants to treat stimulant use disorder. But there are non-psychostimulant, non-controlled substances options that we want every clinician to at least consider. But again, with the caveat of they help people reduce their stimulant use, they don't have the effect size that we see for methadone, buprenorphine, and extended-release naltrexone for opioid use disorder. We're not seeing that same impact from the off-label medications for stimulant use disorder.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that doesn't translate so well. I mean, similarly to, I've had trainees ask me, why don't we give benzos for people with alcohol use disorder? If we use methadone for opioid, and it's like, well, the approach doesn't quite translate all the time.
It just doesn't work. If substitution therapies across the board, across all stimulant, but intoxication categories worked equivalently, things would be easier. But there is real differences in the way that different substances work on the brain, right? And the mu opioid receptor being a singular target, right? You do things to either activate or partial agonize or antagonize that receptor, it seems to impact stimulant use. Whereas, you know, alcohol and benzodiazepines have different binding points on the GABA chloride channel. Psychostimulants, some of them work on the dopamine transporter, some of them work on the vesicular monoamine transporter, some of them work on the dopamine receptor, right? You don't have that, you know, final common pathway for all mechanisms of those drugs that make substitution therapies harder. And so what you're left with is, what can we think would work adjacent or alongside or in combination with to seem to impact substance use? And I might suggest, you know, rather than thinking what is the medication strategy, right? Like for everything, particularly for non-opioid use disorders where medications just don't seem to be as universally effective, the medications can be helpful, right? I make it clear, like meds, even off-label meds can help. But really the task is, how do I support the patient in front of me learn a healthier way of navigating their lives, right? And so that could be everything from, what is the harm reduction strategies that I'm offering that somebody to help protect their health and wellness? If they are interested in changing their substance use, how can I support them changing it in the most healthful way possible? If they are committed to abstinence, how do I provide the appropriate structures and supports, which could everything from residential care, which is a contained environment, plus psychoeducation, plus psychotherapy, plus, you know, linkage to vocational rehab and, you know, connecting somebody to a network of people that don't use drugs, right? I mean, there's a whole number of things that we do in addition to our medications that can have a huge impact on supporting people's health and wellness.
Can you tell us about some harm reduction approaches to consider for patients with stimulant use disorders?
Sure. With stimulant use disorder, one of the things that clinicians should consider is modifiable cardiovascular risk factors. So this is all the stuff that primary care clinicians know around cholesterol, blood pressure, supporting if somebody is using stimulants regularly of potentially considering modifying cardiovascular risk factors to reduce risk. The other thing that happens with psychostimulants, and for anyone that's prescribed a psychostimulant, you'll be familiar with dry mouth, right? And what we see with stimulant drugs of abuse, particularly methamphetamine, which works a long time, is a lot of dental problems, right? So dental care can be actually an important harm reduction strategy so that people can continue to eat and talk and have appropriate dental function. Encouraging people to consider trials of abstinence, that isn't to say that people will stop using forever, but to be intentional about when they're using and when they're not using. If you can give people a break from the stimulant, it can actually have a helpful impact on restoration of sleep and mood and just overall, you know, quality of life and function. And then there's a lot of focus in the harm reduction community around route of administration. So if somebody is going to inject a stimulant, that they use a clean needle every time to avoid spreading infectious disease, and a clean needle every time using as sterile a technique as is manageable helps reduce things like wound infections. Injecting into smaller veins versus bigger veins are things that help reduce sepsis and other systemic infections. And it is always safer to smoke a drug versus inject a drug, because usually people that inject can inject variable amounts, whereas if you smoke a drug, you're usually taking in smaller amounts at a time, so that allows for titration element to sepsis use. So making sure people have access to smoking equipment in addition to injection equipment can be a harm reduction strategy. And then our other harm reduction strategies include, from the classic harm reduction moniker of meet people where they are, right? Like, connect to people where they are, serve as a engagement connector for people to a whole variety of services. So do people need other types of medical care, need other types of mental health care? Do people want substance use treatment? And if so, how do we connect them to it? Low threshold access to addiction medications can be a harm reduction strategy. Are we connecting people to housing and social services? In and of themselves, you might say, well, these are medical services, but when they're offered in a low threshold context for people that are using drugs, can be an important part of a harm reduction strategy.
You know, I do my clinical work through the VA, and there's a huge push at the VA recently for naloxone availability for patients with stimulant use disorders. Is that something that you practice?
Absolutely, and not just stimulant use disorder. So from my vantage point, anyone that's using any category of intoxicant should be offered naloxone, which can reduce opioid overdose, and particularly for people with opioid and stimulant use disorders, because that's where we're seeing a lot of overdoses. I would say people with sedative use disorders, particularly if they're buying sedatives on the street, we're seeing a lot of fentanyl involved in pills that are pressed and sold as though they are sedatives, but in fact have fentanyl in them. So that is also a higher risk population. But let's say somebody's coming into treatment and they're only using cannabis or only drinking alcohol, right? The overdose rates across the United States are so high, and overdose is such a threat to public health. You never know when you're going to be around somebody that overdoses. And so I think of naloxone access as a public health strategy that should be universal. So I actually prescribe naloxone to every patient that I see who's receiving substance use treatment. Not because of an expectation that every single patient's going to overdose, but I don't know when that person is ever going to be in a context where they could save somebody's life. And I would like every person in the United States to have access to opiate overdose antidote medication that could be applied in an emergency situation. Because as you know, when somebody overdoses, you don't have enough time to get them to the hospital to reverse it before they're going to begin to experience brain death, right? You have a few minutes. And so that's why universal access to naloxone is so important.
Fantastic. I think that's everything I wanted to cover. I always ask at the end, is there anything that you think would be helpful to add that I didn't touch on?
So there is sometimes an assumption, oh my goodness, methamphetamine is so bad, we don't have the methadone equivalent. Gosh, drugs are terrible, what do we do? And I'll say, if you look at the just natural history of substance use, what we know from the cocaine epidemic is we saw huge rates of cocaine use in the United States, and then they went down. They didn't go down because everyone died. They went down because people stopped using cocaine. I think we're going to see the same thing with stimulants, right? We're seeing huge rates of stimulant use. They're going up. But I expect that the overdose crisis related to the stimulants, which is, again, driven both by the presence of fentanyl in the drug supply and due to the nature of stimulants themselves, is also, people do recover, is the point I'm making. Yes, these drugs have risks. But if we can keep everyone alive through this overdose crisis, people do recover. And about 75% of people with SUD at some point in their lives, like, they do recover. It's not that people forever have active substance use their entire lives. And we've got really good tools to help with that recovery. Contingency management, cognitive behavioral therapy, high intensity outpatient treatment, and residential treatment can be helpful. We've got these off-label medications. We do have tools. I guess my message is, although stimulant use is worrisome, it is not untreatable. Recovery is possible, and we owe it to our patients to offer the most effective evidence-based tools that we have at our disposal.
I actually like closing on that message of a little bit of hope, because you're right. Sometimes, especially when you don't have a sort of silver bullet, it feels hopeless. Thank you very much. Our newsletter clinical update is available for subscribers to read in the Carlyle Addiction Treatment Report. Hopefully people will check it out. Everything from Carlyle Publishing is independently researched and produced. There's no funding from the pharmaceutical industry. Our newsletters and books depend entirely on reader support. There are no ads, and our authors have not received industry funding. That helps us bring you unbiased information that you can trust. And don't forget, you can earn CME credits for listening to our podcasts. As always, thanks for listening, and have a great day.